Hi everyone, this is René Aubergenois. I played Odo on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and I'm the voice behind many of your favorite animated characters, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hey there, fanboys and fangirls around the world. Welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. I hope you had an amazing free comic book day. I know I did. Man, this was fun today. If you're listening to this episode of Comic Book Central on the premiere date, Saturday when it hits, then it is the 15th anniversary of Free Comic Book Day. 15 years! Man, I cannot believe it's been that long. That 15 years of fun and free comics, man, that has been... What a nice ride that is. Continues to get bigger and bigger each year. I made the rounds of my favorite comic book shops here in Columbus, Ohio. I hope you hit up some of your favorite comic book shops as well. I hit up the Laughing Ogre, Comic Town, World's Greatest Comics, More Comics. We've got a lot of comic book shops here in Columbus. And Pack Rat Comics. That was cool. They were doing some free silk screening on shirts today. So you bring a shirt in, they would silk screen it for free. I went with Team Cap. Hashtag Team Cap, and Stuber Girl, she went with Team Stark, hashtag Team Stark. Lots of fun was had. Great movie, by the way. If you haven't seen Civil War, just go see it. It's epic. I hope you and your family had an incredible free comic book day today. I hope you kids of all ages got the free comic books you wanted. I hope you had some fun along the way. Hope you supported your local comic book stores by buying some stuff. Keep them in business. That's how it keeps going. Maybe some of those comic books you bought were Star Trek Deep Space Nine issues. Those comic books, man, there are a lot of them out there. Both Malibu and Marvel Comics, they put out monthly books years ago. DC's Wildstorm had a couple of miniseries. You've got the Next Generation Deep Space Nine comic book crossovers. Those are some great stories. Current Star Trek comic book license holder, IDW, they had their own miniseries as well. So there's a lot of Star Trek Deep Space Nine comics out there. If you don't have them, ask for the books at your local comic book store. Maybe they'll get them in. You can find them online. Some great original Deep Space Nine stories out there. I'm having a blast revisiting Deep Space Nine on Netflix, too. If you missed the series back in the day, go check it out on Netflix. I'm binge watching a lot of great episodes. The Tribble episode is my favorite one. Really underrated show, too. I think this was it was considered the darker version of Star Trek back in the day, but... 2016, of course, it's the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. I'm celebrating all year long with Trek guests. Got one today. This year, you've already heard from original series executive producer Herb Solo. He was on episode 109. Next Generation's Brent Spiner. He played Data. I brought him some pie at Wizard World Cleveland. You can hear that story if you haven't heard it already. It's pretty cool. Episode 116. If you are a Star Trek fan and you haven't already, man, you are going to want to subscribe to Comic Book Central in iTunes or catch up with the show on Blueberry and Stitcher if you're not using iTunes. Or if you're a new listener, a lot of new listeners coming in. I'm getting messages and people joining the show. Welcome. Subscribe to the show on iTunes. Go back and get those episodes. They're awesome. You can find every episode archived also at the website, comicbookcentral.net. They're all there. If you're in iTunes, just take a minute. Leave a review. 5 stars would be great if you really like the show. Always appreciated. That helps get the word out to even more people. Thanks to all those who have done that. Again, those past episodes, Trek guests include the great William Shatner, Captain Kirk himself, he was here, Jonathan Frakes and Marina Sirtis from Deep Space Nine. If you're a Deep Space Nine fan, probably you are listening to this episode right now. Chase Masterson, Michael Dorn, Terry Farrell, they've all joined me. So after you listen to today's episode, go back and check those episodes out if you haven't already. Comic Book Central is also on Twitter and Facebook. The episodes, I post them there every Saturday. So like and follow. You won't miss any of the excitement. Retweet it, share it, get the word out. While you're on Facebook, be sure to check out the Deep Space Nine fan club. My thanks to those folks out there for sending in some questions to my email address. It's joe@comicbookcentral.net. They sent some questions in. I'm going to bring some of those questions out on today's episode, also next week's episode. So big thanks to those Trekkers out there. Why am I doing it on next week's episode as well? Because Deep Space Nine is the theme of back-to-back episodes here on Comic Book Central. On next week's show, you are going to hear from actress Nana Visitor. She played Major Kira Nerys on the series. And in just a few minutes, actor René Aubergenois, he's going to be sitting down with me right here in the lair. He played Odo on Deep Space Nine. Also, he was the voice of Spider-Man on a very cool rock album back in the 70s. If you heard last week's episode, I'm sure you did, right? You know exactly what that album is. Someone put the audio of it on YouTube. I'm going to link that in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net. You can hear it there. Last week, I spoke with the singing voice of Spidey, Ron Dante. This week, it's the swinging Spidey. Let's get a little bit more information on my special guest today. Then I'm going to be right back to talk with the versatile actor who can morph into any role, the great René Auberjonois. René was a world traveler at a very early age. Born in New York City, his family traveled to Paris and to London before returning to the States, where René graduated from the Carnegie Institute of Technology in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The theater was René's first love, and his first role on Broadway was as the fool in King Lear. A year later, he was awarded a Tony for his work in Coco with Katharine Hepburn. Man, nice start. Then back-to-back films with legendary director Robert Altman, MASH and Brewster McCloud. Again, nice film start. He also appeared in the thriller The Eyes of Laura Mars, and it didn't get much bigger on the big screen than the 1976 remake of King Kong. If your television was on for any amount of time in the 70s and 80s, you saw René in series after series. Mod Squad, The Jeffersons, The Bob Newhart Show, Charlie's Angels, one of our favorites, Man from Atlantis, seven seasons of the smash ABC hit Benson as Clayton Endicott III, for which he received an Emmy nomination. And of course, he teamed up with, the Superwoman duo of Wonder Woman and the Bionic Woman. More recently, Warehouse 13, The Librarians, Boston Legal, and The Practice, where René got his second Emmy nomination. Voiceover work, it's almost endless. He's Disney's Chef Louis in The World of the Little Mermaid, General Zod in Superman, Desaad, follower of the evil Darkseid in The Super Friends. And as you may have heard on last week's show, back in 1972, while Ron Dante was singing as Spidey in Spider-Man, a rock comic, René was swinging as Spidey in Peter Parker. He also battled a bunch of villains, including the Kingpin, and he got to act out the classic Spider-Man origin.
Walking home, I couldn't shake the odd sensation which tingled through my body. Then, as a couple of local creeps tried to pick a fight...
Hey, look out, Mac.
Sorry,
This'll teach you to watch where you're walking, you four-eyed follow-up.
I hardly felt it. My reflex action worked so fast I couldn't control it. I snapped that steel lamppost in two with one punch.
Let's get out of here, that cat's a tiger.
Something's happening to me. I've changed, but how? Why? That car coming right at me. I have to leap aside. What's come over me? Am I going mad? I'm scaling this wall just as easily as I can walk. I'm like some sort of giant insect, like a wall-crawling human spider.
But it was 1993 when René cemented his place in sci-fi history. That's when he took on the role of the changeling Odo on the hit series Star Trek Deep Space Nine. For seven seasons, René walked and protected the promenade of Space Station Deep Space Nine as the shape-shifting chief of security Odo. He even got to visit the original Star Trek series through a crossover episode, Trials and Tribulations, and he found romance with Kira Nerys, played by actress Nana Visitor.
Odo, wait.
Major, if you don't mind, I'd like to forget all about last night.
I don't think that's a good idea. We need to talk about what happened.
Very well, then we can meet in my office in an hour.
No, let's discuss it over dinner.
Dinner?
Now, you can choose a restaurant, anywhere but a Holosuite.
What about Shakar? Do you think he'll approve?
Look, I don't care whether he approves or not. Shakar and I are friends. That's all, friends. The First Minister asked me to update him on the war with the Dominion. My visit was strictly business. Now, are we going to have dinner together or not?
And if we do, then what?
I don't know. Maybe we could go dancing.
And after that, I suppose you'll expect me to kiss you.
Well, that's possible.
But then who needs dinner? Why don't I just get it over with and kiss you right now?
Well, why don't you?
My guest today is a star of stage and screen. He is an Emmy-nominated, Tony Award-winning actor. Today he is here to help me celebrate 50 years of Star Trek. From Star Trek Deep Space Nine, I want to welcome René Auberjonois. René, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Joe, great to be here. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. This is, we're celebrating Star Trek 50th anniversary all year long. I mean, this is just, you get to be a part of this whole Star Trek universe. At what point did you realize how big this was going to be? Are you still amazed? It just, I mean, it's making headlines even today.
Yeah, it is amazing. You know, the first inkling I ever got was Nick Meyer, a friend and colleague, was preparing to shoot one of the Star Trek original feature films, The Undiscovered Country. And he called me and he said, you know, I'm asking a bunch of my friends if they would be willing to do cameos, just small parts in the film. Would you consider doing that? And I said, Nick, sure, you know, unless I get a real job. Little did I know. And,
yeah, this shouldn't take up much of your time, right?
Right. Well, you know, it was going to be a day or two's work, you know.
Yeah.
And so I have a family to raise. And I thought, well, if I get a real job or a job that's – anyway, so I went along and I had to go for a costume fitting and to be outfitted as a Starfleet officer. And I've been – by that time in my life, I'd been to hundreds of costume fittings, and I went and I was fitted very carefully for this uniform. And when it finished, the costume designer said, boy, now you're in for it. And I didn't really understand what she meant. Now, years later, of course, I do realize that just being able to dip my foot into that universe was going to be a big deal.
Yeah.
And then shortly afterwards, I signed on to do Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And totally coincidentally, I mean, Rick Berman, who was producing Star Trek Deep Space Nine, I don't think, I've actually never asked Rick that. I don't think he was even, you know, aware of the fact of my relationship that I had done. Well, he probably wasn't, now that I think about it, because
that's what I was always wondering about, because it's like you kind of assume based on timing that maybe, oh, they remembered you from Star Trek. So even though, and we'll talk about a little bit about this, your scenes are cut, they're put back in DVD later, well, but
that's why I was going to say.
Yeah, you kind of wonder, like, did you get it because of that, or was it just happenstance?
I'm sure not.
Okay.
Just as I'm pretty sure that when I did Boston Legal, I don't think David Kelly really connected the fact that I had been, you know, a character in Star Trek. I'm sure he was aware of Bill Shatner's involvement, but I don't know whether he was aware of mine.
Well, you mentioned your friend Nicholas Meyer. We'll get into the Star Trek stuff here in a bit, but you mentioned Nicholas Meyer. He has not left the world of Star Trek. He is now currently back in the world of Star Trek. He called in a favor. You did a few days' work, Star Trek VI for him. Have you guys spoken recently?
No.
Okay.
No, I've spoken to Nick in a few years, actually.
Okay.
We just lost track of each other. And that happens in this business, and it doesn't have anything to do with, you know, hard feeling and nothing like that. It just, you know, lives, you know, circles in circles and wheels within wheels, and you miss each other, and you just sort of lives keep trundling along. And at my age, it's terrifying how fast it all goes sweeping by. You know, speaking of connections, I had totally lost track with Harv Bennett, who gave me my very first job in television, a wonderful role when he was the producer of Mod Squad.
I mean, great show.
Eons ago.
Yeah, great show.
He had seen me in the theater, performing in the theater up in San Francisco, and I got this offer out of the blue, and I'd never done a guest shot on a television show. In fact, the only film I'd done up to that point, and I don't even know if it was out yet, was MASH, the feature film of MASH. But anyway, Harv Bennett did it, and we became great friends, and I worked for him I did a movie for television, The Birdmen of Bekstad, or maybe it was ended up just being called The Birdmen. But anyway, I lost track of Harv, and he lost track of me. And then one day I was getting ready to – I came onto the set of Boston Legal, and there he was sitting there talking to Bill Shatner.
Hollywood is a small world. Well, the reason I asked about Nicholas Meyer was he's hinted recently – he's doing the writing. He's handling the heavy lifting on the writing for the new Star Trek television series. I'm sure you've heard something about that. He's kind of hinted that it takes place maybe between Star Trek VI and your era on Deep Space Nine. So I'm just curious, like, if your phone's been ringing, maybe a return trip. I don't know.
No, well, okay. I would be very surprised if that were the case. But okay.
I had to ask it. We're, you know.
Sure.
Star Trek, look, it's for some actors, it just always comes around. We see people popping up, so it'd be kind of interesting. Look, we're talking about Star Trek. You are famous for your role as a shapeshifter. I think that's kind of a metaphor for your entire career, though, isn't it?
Well, I would like to think so. I mean, it's everything I always wanted to be as an actor from the time I was very, very young. I always wanted to be – I'm not sure I even knew that what I wanted to be was a character actor. But I knew that the actors that turned me on and that I was just always surprised by were actors who – from role to role seemed to shapeshift and change. And, you know, someone like Alec Guinness in my dreams, but, you know, someone just recently on Twitter asked if, the role I played on Benson, Clayton Endicott III, had, how was it preparation for playing Odo? And I said, well, my response was simply apples and oranges.
Yeah.
Because it just never, I never thought about, I've played a lot of nitwits and effete fops as Clayton Endicott III certainly was. But I certainly didn't think that about the character of Odo.
I'm sure there's maybe some connection there somewhere deep. We get into the we'll get your character from Frasier to psychoanalyze it.
Exactly. But the fact is, you know, no matter how much you like to think that you're totally unrecognizable from character to character, I am simply the instrument that plays the writer's music. And so, you know, if I am whatever my instrument is, am I a cello or a bassoon or
Odo? You could be whatever you want. You could be a trumpet. You could be a guitar. Didn't he say in one thing he's a table in one thing and a tuba in the next or something? Yeah.
But the metaphor of the instrument is sort of I'm stuck with whatever instrument I have, you know, and then I can try to play a lot of different kinds of music on it, but it's still going to be me. And so I accept that.
Well, before we continue with some of your on-screen appearances, ones where we do get to see you, I want to talk a little bit about some of the roles where we don't see you. You're a little bit behind the scenes, some of your tremendous voiceover roles. This has got to be one of the coolest things on your resume. Look, it's Comic Book Central. I believe when you were in college is probably when Spider-Man would have hit comic book stands. Were your buddies, your college buddies, reading Spider-Man? Did you know about the character? You got to play him a few years later.
I always loved comics, and comic books. I mean, from childhood, and it was a thing that was. I'm incredibly grateful that my father was very encouraging about my brothers and my love for comic books, which seems kind of counterintuitive. You expect parents, especially, you know, we were first generation, my brother and I, and my father was from a kind of a strict Swiss background. But his father was a painter, and my father was a wonderful illustrator himself, although he made his living as a writer. But he just when we started bringing home comic books, spending our 10-cent allowance on comic books, He just would sit and look at them with us and point out things and admire them. And it didn't matter whether it was Scrooge McDuck or the original Mad comic books before it became a magazine, or Tales from the Crypt or Spider-Man or whatever. He just loved them and was very approving of my involvement with them and my interest in them. So yeah, I was very aware of Spider-Man. Not that I ever thought I would be doing the voice of Peter Parker. And that came, interesting that you mentioned college buddies, that came through a guy who was also at Carnegie. Well, now it's called Carnegie Mellon. When I went there in the far past, it was called Carnegie Institute of Technology. And it was short, not all that long after I had graduated from university and started my career, and I was in New York, and he contacted me and asked me to do it, and I did. And it continues to amaze me that I'll go to Star Trek conventions and people will walk up with a copy of the album and ask me to sign it, and it's great.
Do you have a copy of it, of your own?
I do now. How did I end up? I had lost the copy, or I may have given it to my son, who took it off to college when he went, and he may have lost it. But somehow I did end up with a fan at a convention. When he brought me a copy of the album to sign, I said, "Oh my God, I don't know where my copy is." And he came back the next day and presented me with a copy of it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
one of the perks. One of the perks
of being Spider-Man. Yeah. Did you meet with any of the Marvel people? Did you meet with Stan Lee? Do you recall any of the cast? The only cast member besides yourself. Well, we talked to Ron Dante. But I know Thayer David, I think, played Kingpin.
Right. Well, I met all those guys and have bumped into a lot of them over the years.
So you met up with Stan Lee at the time?
Well, the way I met Stan Lee, and he would probably have no memory of this, but I can't even tell you the date, but it was sometime in the 70s. There was a celebration. It was at Town Hall in New York City. It was called A Marvelous Evening with Stan Lee. And this was way ahead of its time, but way before the big craze of, bringing these characters to life. I was one of the people who performed. I read a monologue from Spider-Man with Charlie Mingus, the great jazz artist, performing behind me, supporting me. I remember Tom Wolfe, the wonderful writer of Bonfire of the Vanities and The Right Stuff. Tom Wolfe performed a piece from Captain America. Chuck McCann, somebody else, did The Hulk. I can't remember.
Wow.
But it was a great evening. I don't think it was ever recorded. And it was, I don't know whose idea it was. I just came in and did it. And it was kind of mind blowing and had a great crowd. And I'm sure it wasn't recorded.
Well, that'd be great to get a hold of that if it was.
Wouldn't that be great? I should Google it.
It's your performance, it's Spider-Man from Beyond the Grave, so the warning is clearly on the package. We're getting these things. But it's a really dark take. I mean, there, you know, the Kingpin, there's these nightmarish visions. What do you think of it? I mean, when was the last time you heard it? What did you think of it?
Well, I haven't heard it. I'd be lying if I said I've heard it. I haven't heard it in years, and I couldn't even. Mostly I remember what I loved about it was you opened it up, you opened the album up, and there the two leaves of the album, there were the illustration, the comic book was right there. And I remember the music was great. That's pretty much all. I'm sorry. You know, I'm not going to be much help to you. At this point in my life, if you look on IMDb at my credits for the voiceover stuff I've done, people will contact me or mention things, and I'll go, really? I did that? I have, yeah. You know.
I have a hard time remembering what I did last week, let alone, you know, 40 years ago. But you talk about some of these things. Super Friends, The World of Super Friends, you got to play Desaad. You got to play General Zod in the Superman animated series.
Right.
You know, were you a fan of Superman?
I loved Superman. Are you kidding?
Yeah. So, and these are coming after the movies, too, at least the Superman one.
Right.
So were you kind of like channeling maybe a little bit of Terrence Stamp with your Zod?
In my dreams. I don't even, you know, I'm not even sure I was, you know, making those connections. Yeah. A lot of times, you know, the low down truth is my voiceover agent will call on a Friday and say, on Monday, if you can be at such and such in studio, and you know, at 10:30, and it's a 2-hour gig, and I'll go there and they'll hand me a script and I'll read it, and then I'll go into the studio and we'll sort of try a couple of different voices, and then they'll say, that's good, and then we'll do it and I'll leave. You know, it's the nature of voiceover work. And I am not the kind of voiceover performer. The people who that's all they do, they're just geniuses at being able to just grab a voice out of thin air. And
yeah, like I looked at some of these voiceovers, and it just goes back, you know, decades and decades. It's just the stuff is amazing. Look, before we get to Star Trek stuff, and I do want to get to that, we are going to celebrate Star Trek 50. I got to ask you about some of these things. Kind of a speed run on some of these projects. I know we're going back away, so just any memories you have of any of these things I want to check out. No fembots or furry Sasquatches in your trip to the world of bionics, but we do have in The Bionic Woman fashionable sweaters and French forgeries. The Bionic Woman, season 2, The Dejan Caper. Did you get to channel some of your family history here? You mentioned French painting.
Right. My grandfather was a Swiss painter.
Also René, right?
Yes, also René Auberginois, and also but from the French part of Switzerland, so I suppose I was channeling some of that. Someone actually tweeted a picture of Lindsay and myself.
Yeah, that's yours truly.
From that, oh, it was. Oh, for goodness sake! Oh,
yeah, you and I have been chatting the last couple of days.
No, I go through those things sometimes quickly. What do you remember? What I responded about? You asked me if she what was the question you asked?
Well,
me?
your hair's kind of out there a little bit, and hers is a little flat. And I kind of asked if she had wondered about the kind of conditioner you were using, and you focused a little more on the wardrobe.
Yeah, because I looked at that picture. I don't remember that vest at all. But you know, yeah, that was boy, that look at that hair.
You get to go full French accent with that too. I mean, it's probably like you probably just at the edge of going, you know, spoof with the French accent, I think, at that point.
Of going Chef Louis from The Mermaid. Yes. Just short of that.
Just pull it back in a little bit. It's bionics, but we got to, you know.
Yeah, right. And you know, so many years later, Lindsay and I got to work together on Warehouse 13.
Yes.
Eventually our characters sort of seemed to have gotten married somewhere along the line, which was a surprise to both of us, but it was in one of the late last episodes of Warehouse 13, and it might have been just a fantasy section. I'm not sure.
Well, you get these surprise sci-fi romances in your career, so they come out of nowhere. It's always kind of neat. Another fantastic actress here. Wonder Woman, season 3, Spaced Out. Look, this was one of the episodes that's probably a favorite of fanboys and fangirls everywhere. The episode takes place at a science fiction convention. How great
little did I know.
Little did you know.
Yeah, and well, God, is it you who posted?
Of course it was.
Of course it was. And which you can barely see me because my character, and you even knew the name of it, which I couldn't have told you. The Black Avenger.
The Black Avenger. That's right. Yeah. Well, you kind of beat up the Black Avenger and took his costume.
Oh, is that what it is? Yeah. But yeah, that costume was.
You're a thief. You're a dirty thief. Look, you're a forger in Bionic Woman. You're a dirty thief in Wonder Woman. My goodness. Yeah. Thank goodness you got Odo.
But I seem to remember I got away with it in Wonder Woman.
You did. You sneaked into Robbie the Robot's costume. I was wondering if you actually got to be in Robbie the Robot's costume.
No, I didn't.
Okay, I didn't think so. But
No, I didn't get to do that.
But you did tell me a great story on Twitter about Linda Carter, though.
Oh, yeah, Linda Carter. Talk about hot and a beautiful woman and very sweet. And I was very shy to ask her for an autographed picture for my son. And it really was for our son. And my son still has that picture because now it's a real collector's item. And it's kind of a hoot. He has it in his office and people look at it and go, what? But he also has a signed autographed picture from the witch from The Wizard of Oz, Hamilton.
Margaret Hamilton,
because I did a play with Margaret Hamilton years ago. And we were rehearsing one day and she said to me, Renee, do you have children? And I said, yeah, I do. She said, how old are they? And I told her. And the next day she brought in these wonderful photographs of her as the witch. Wow. And she had written on them, little bubble coming out of her mouth, I'll get you, Remy. And Tessa is our daughter. And then only Tessa one. And you, Tessa, I'll get you, Tessa.
Nice.
And your little dog, too.
Nice. It's good to have you as a dad. That's for sure.
Well,
real quick, too, any memories on Batman Forever? You got to hang out in Arkham Asylum with Nicole Kidman and Jim Carrey.
I did. That, again, was one of the – I was shooting Star Trek at the time, and they graciously allowed – they fiddled the schedule around so that I could go over and do that. And it was all done in one day. And I've been told that actually it was two scenes, one at the beginning and one near the end, and I think they cut the last one. So I'm really only in the beginning.
You got to shoot early, I think, with Tommy Lee Jones. That scene was cut, correct?
Right.
Okay, so yeah, you kind of cap off the end of the film with Jim Carrey going nuts and he thinks he's Batman. So you kind of end the film, which is awesome. But there's a deleted scene with you and Tommy Lee Jones, right? Or at least you go into an empty cell and he's gone.
Yeah, no, he's gone. I think because I would remember if I'd worked with Tommy.
Yeah.
Film, because of course we did Eyes of Laura Mars together. So
yeah, you've been with everybody.
I knew him and admired him, but I got to work with Nicole, and even though I didn't get to work with Jim Carrey, I got to sit in the makeup room with him, and we laughed and talked, and it was great.
Okay.
But mostly I remember that the idea was for me to look like a sort of caricature of Tim Burton.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, you're actually named Dr. Burton.
That's why he's called Dr. Burton, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very, very cool film. Look, I apologize. I know the time is getting away from us, but can we talk Star Trek?
Sure.
There's so many awesome things on your resume. This is what we love. You know, we talked about Star Trek VI. That was kind of like your introduction there. Star Trek Deep Space Nine. This is a series that Entertainment Weekly called the Trek franchise's most compelling series. How, other than Star Trek VI, your time, like, you were familiar with Star Trek itself, though, right? I mean, like,
I don't know how you could be,
yeah,
you know, a conscious
human
person in our culture and not be, you know, people say, oh, well, I don't watch science fiction or I don't know anything about science fiction.
Right.
And of course, they know a lot more than they are admitting to, it's just because you can't. I mean, it has so infiltrated and been absorbed into our culture and it has so much to do with who we are and how we think about some aspects of our relationship to other human beings. And that was the genius of the show. And and its capacity to open people's minds up to, and it's ironic to be talking about this these days when there's so much concern about aliens, illegal aliens, and not to get too political about this, but I would just love to know what Gene Roddenberry's take would be on all of this. Because, I mean, that's what Star Trek was talking about the fact that we have to learn to live with all the aliens that are around us. And so there you go. That's well, my
last. It's interesting you say that, because your friend Nicholas Meyer, as on the director's commentary for Star Trek VI, he mentioned that no matter what Star Trek you watch, it's kind of a product of its time. And you think about the 60s Star Trek and, you know, civil rights and, you know, how that was reflected in the storylines. Yeah. His movie, you know, The Fall of the Soviet Union, it's coming right. I think it premiered like 20 days before the official Fall of the Soviet Union, things like that. So it's interesting you mentioned that take. Were you surprised at how dark it was? I mean, we talk about how dark Spider-Man, the rock comic, was, but my goodness. I mean.
You talk about a product of its time.
Yeah.
Rick Berman and Michael Piller put together the basic concept of Star Trek Deep Space Nine at the very time that the riots were happening in Los Angeles, the burning of the whole Crenshaw district. And there was that affected that was in the ether as they were creating the world of Deep Space Nine. I loved the fact that it was so dark, and it's the neurotic Star Trek. It's the one where everybody, every character has some deep psychic problem that they have to work out. Every single one of them, except maybe not Sisko's son, but even he wanting to be, you know, his struggle to be a writer, you know. So I wasn't surprised. I was proud to be part of that. And I knew at the time that we were doing it that it wasn't everybody's favorite Star Trek. Some people found it too dark. And but I had confidence, and I have confidence today, that it's a version of Star Trek that will have a pretty good shelf life in terms of people being able to relate to it. You know, all sci-fi things, as you get farther and farther away from the moment they were created, tend to take on a kind of a retro feeling. But I think the darkness of Deep Space Nine will serve it well.
I got some listener questions from the folks at the Deep Space Nine fan club on Facebook. I'll throw some of these out here. Max Kaiserman wants to know. He says, Odo, of course, a character who started out as rather gruff and emotionless, he says, turned into one of the greatest love stories in all of Star Trek. What was the most challenging aspect of acting this from within a mask? Would you have changed anything? And he kind of references maybe even Odo's face from Children of Time, where you kind of look like, I think, you in that one a little bit more.
Yeah. I am, you know, the mask, which was a word that Rick Berman was not, he didn't like, he was not happy with the idea that I was wearing a mask, only because he thought, well, it's a story I've told before, but the original makeup was a whole bunch of small pieces, and it was a hell to put on, and it kept breaking down. And I said to Mike Westmore, can't we make it a mask? And he said, no, we don't use that word mask, because Rick feels that you won't be able to express anything. And I had studied mask work and eventually taught mask work at Juilliard, the drama school. And I was very aware that masks, maybe counterintuitively, actually help you project emotions rather than hide emotions. And so eventually, within the first season, we moved into a full face piece. And so I found it quite liberating, oddly enough, because I was aware that we show our emotions with our bodies, our voices, our eyes, and just the tilt of your head can project an emotion, can actually magnify it. And so the love story, the only thing I would say weird about the love story, both Nana and I were totally like, it came out of left field for us. We were dear friends, as the characters were supposed to be in the beginning, just really dear friends. She was the only one who Odo trusted and the one who really understood him. And it was really, I think, in the second season, an episode called Necessary Evil, which had a flashback. And at the end of it, Odo discovers that she has been responsible for a crime. But now in the present, in the script, it said Odo, he's looking at her and he, you know, tells her that he knows the truth, and he's looking at her, and I think the stage direction said something about his disappointment and his whatever, I don't remember exactly, but apparently in dailies the next day when they were looking at the film that had been shot, they were sitting and looking at it, and when they came to my close-up, someone in the room said, oh my God, he's in love with her. And they went on with that. And both Nana and I went, what? Well, ours is not to question why. And we went ahead with it, you know, and worked on it. And then, of course, it ultimately culminates in the big kiss on the promenade, which lovers of romance in Star Trek, they just loved that. And both Nana and I remember turning to her as we were about to do the big clinch, and it was sort of like going to kiss your sister or something. And I said, okay, come on, we're pros, we can handle this. And we went down, we did the thing, we did the big kiss, and they called cut, and we separated, and all the orange had come off of my face onto her face. And the fact is, I've often said it was like the safest sex you could ever have, because I had, you know, a quarter of an inch of latex between me and her face. So it wasn't like a real turn on, I can tell you the truth.
There's a storyline I don't think was explored too often there. Okay. Listener Philip Watson, he wants to know more about Odo and Kira. He says, you said before you felt it was a mistake for Odo's love for Kira to go from unrequited to being in a relationship with her. I still remember being blown away by your performance in Crossfire, as we saw Odo's love being taken away and the touching scene with Quark. Looking back now, do you still think it was a mistake, or do you think it was a good character arc for Odo?
No,
it gave you more scripts, didn't it?
Of course it was. It was not a mistake. I mean, I thought it was a mistake when they found out, you know, when I started the character of Odo, he didn't know where he was from. He didn't know if there were any others like him. And people would say to me, oh, I hope we find out. I would say, no, I don't want to find out. I think that's the fascinating thing about the character. And then the writers called me in at the start of the next season and they said, we're going to find out. And I thought, oh, that's a mistake. But then, of course, it just opened up a whole bunch of other things. It opened a door into, you know, what became a very important aspect of the whole story arc of Deep Space Nine. And that's the same is true for the love that that Odo feels for Kira. And it just teaches you a lesson that when a door closes, another one opens, and you just have to go with the flow. And if you're open to it, wonderful new things happen.
You mentioned earlier showrunner Ira Stephen Baer. He called the episode Trials and Tribulations probably the most expensive hour of episodic television ever produced. I don't know that I can disagree with him on that. $3 million. Is this the biggest DS9 episode?
Gee, I would have thought Far Beyond the Stars was more expensive. But, of course, it didn't have all those special effects. And
plus, you didn't have to pay the original cast residuals too.
Well, there you go, and and you know, on a trivial level, trivial.
Yeah.
I remember that the prop people and the scenic designers talking about, there were these kind of chairs that were in the original version. They're these pseudo-modern chairs, but they couldn't find them anywhere, and they had to recreate them. And that was cost thousands of dollars to make this cheap little plastic chair that they probably bought in some furniture store.
It's like lawn furniture, right?
I don't know what it was, but
yeah,
anyway,
they're like these cheapest little things you could, like, they look like school chairs.
That's right. And they had to recreate them in order to match the thing. So yes, I'm sure it was, but I think it was worth it. It's one of the favorite episodes. And
was it one of the favorites for you? Because it's, you take us back to there. First of all, I want to know what your experience was like being on basically the original Enterprise, and who was the biggest fanboy or fangirl on the set?
Oh,
from the cast.
Armin. I think you'd have to say Armin was the biggest and knew the most. But then that's who Armin is. I mean, he's just this intensely brilliant guy and a bit of a nerd. And I would say he was the one who knew all the history, but all of us, I mean, whether it was Terry Farrell or all of us, were just gobsmacked at the fact that we were going to get to be somehow, whether it wasn't virtual, but we were going to be with the gold standard, the original, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know. It just was like, it was
the
just
the classic
amazing.
Cast. I mean, the original yes. crew, you guys are part of that story now.
I know. Amazing. Amazing. And we were all sort of giddy with the idea of it. And our costumes and our makeup and our hair and how they changed everything so we could look like we somehow fit into it.
Didn't you say you thought you looked like Jerry Lee Lewis at one point?
If I did, I agree. I agree with myself.
Do you agree with your past self? Yeah. You got to throw down the bar fight. That's like one of the classic scenes.
Yeah.
I mean, you actually get to throw a punch too, or kind of like a karate chop or something too. Was it just, I mean, just describe putting all that to, I mean, how, as an actor, how challenging was that to just, from a technical perspective, of trying to match 1967?
Yeah, by that time, I had been, you know, my character, probably more than any of the others up until that point, had to do more kind of special effect stuff where I had to, you know, be melting or not, you know, and I would have to trust that the computer was going to take over at a certain point. And so I was fascinated, interested, but I wasn't particularly uncomfortable with it. I mean, you know, when I did King Kong, the remake of King Kong, it was, you know, we spent a lot of time staring at nothing.
And not even Rick Baker in like a folding chair.
And being amazed. Yeah, no. No, so, yeah, no, I just was aware of how lucky I was. And have been ever since about my involvement with Star Trek. It is the gift that keeps on giving. And this year, the 50th year, and, you know, I look at my schedule. I'm going to be in Ottawa. I'm going to be in Houston. I'm going to be in Miami. I'm going to be in New York. I'm going to be in Las Vegas. I'm going to be in Connecticut. I'm going to be all over the map. I was in Wales and Northern Ireland and England. And it's just been this tremendous source of, you know, when you work in the theater, as I, that's where my roots are, in the theater, and you're used to an audience, interacting with an audience on a nightly basis. But in film and television, you know, apart from people sort of recognizing you on the street, there's no experience like the experience of actually going and meeting the audience that has supported and made your work possible for so many years. And that's a real gift that Star Trek has given all of us.
One of those appearances I know you're going to be making is in Connecticut in August. You're going to be at Trificon.
Right.
I'm going to be at Trificon.
Fantastic. Well, you better come and say hello.
I will come and say hello. I'll buy you a drink. Are you kidding me? I'll buy you a drink at this point. Okay. Maybe we'll hit Quark's Bar and throw some back here. Doctors Without Borders.
Right.
I want to mention that as well. That's a charity that you are very passionate about. What can you tell us about Doctors Without Borders?
Well, you know, when I started Star Trek and I was going to the conventions and I was signing autographs and I thought, well, this is fun. It's great. And I'm, you know, as I said, it's a real gift to meet the people who make your work possible. But I kept thinking, I don't know if I can do this on and on and on without finding some way to make it more than just, you know, enough about me. What do you think about me? I mean, listen, I'm an actor. I have a perfectly healthy ego, but I really felt I needed to do something. And I remember talking to Armin and his wife, Kitty. And I said, I've got to find a charity or something that I can do something for. And they talked about Médecins Sans Frontières or Doctors Without Borders. And I looked into it and I read about it. And then I became passionate about it. And so for the past 20 years or so, I've been, as well as signing autographs, I draw my bucket cartoon of Odo in the bucket. And people have been incredibly generous. And over the years, in fact, I just was down at the Doctors Without Borders offices in New York yesterday, dropping off an envelope of Canadian dollars that I had collected the last time I did a convention in Canada. And it has made it all worthwhile. And the generosity of the fans has meant that I've been able to raise really significant amounts of money for a great cause. I mean, this is an organization, totally apolitical, going around the world, going into places that are too dangerous for the Red Cross or anyone else to go into. And they've also suffered terrible losses in war. And so it's just allowed me to do something that makes me feel good about myself and good about the world, because it's an organization that is doing good all over the world.
We can find more about this, sure, at your Twitter feed. You mentioned that. You can be found on Twitter where?
Or ReneeFiles.com. That we have a lot of stuff about it there. And Twitter. I'm on Twitter. And I'm not on Facebook. I just can't. I mean, I can't handle it all. There's just too much, too few hours in the day. But I try to stay on top of the Twitter feed and answer people. And through that, you can find out how to go to the ReneeFiles.com, where you can find out a lot about Doctors Without Borders.
And you do. You're very interactive with people on Twitter. Look, you got us nerds out there asking you questions and you respond. As a hardcore nerd, I appreciate that.
Well,
you're very kind, sir. Look, Renee, we love all of your roles. We cannot wait to see what you morph into next. I thank you for celebrating 50 years of Star Trek with me today on Comic Book Central.
Thanks, Joe. Take care.
As I said earlier, the Star Trek celebration continues next week right here on Comic Book Central. You're going to want to come back for this. Going to be chatting with Renee's castmate from Deep Space Nine. They fell in love on the show. They're best friends in real life. Actress Nana Visitor, she is going to be visiting next week. A lot of Deep Space Nine here in the lair. My thanks to Renee Aubergenois for joining us today. Links to Renee's website and Twitter can be found in the show notes for this episode at my website. It's comicbookcentral.net. Check it out there. There you can also find links to Comic Book Central on Twitter, Facebook, and of course, iTunes, where you are going to want to subscribe to the show if you haven't already. You don't want to miss a moment of fun. As I said, more Star Trek 50th anniversary celebrations on the way, definitely next week with Nana Visitor. 75th anniversaries of a bunch of characters. Archie Andrews, Green Arrow, Aquaman. I'm on it, folks. Trust me. And Spider-Man. More Spider-Man's coming up. Back-to-back episodes of Spidey are going to be coming up. And in a very special episode, a Comic Book Central exclusive Shazam surprise. That is coming your way in mere days. It's going to be here before you know it. Like the show on Facebook, follow it on Twitter, subscribe in iTunes, Blueberry, Stitcher, wherever you get it. Don't miss a moment of it. Week after week, we're bringing the fun here in Comic Book Central. And email me at joe@comicbookcentral.net. I want to hear from you. Tell me your favorite episodes. Tell me some guest ideas you have. That's what listener Ernest Edwards did. Ernest writes, he says, "Howdy, Joe. Loved your interview with Ron Dante. He is as timeless as the Archie's music itself. I listened to and watched the Spider-Man Rock comic on YouTube last year. I wish someone would release it on a CD like Spider-Man Rock Reflections of a Superhero has been. Now, a while back, you reminded one of your listeners that many of the folks behind the Archie cartoon and radio show have since passed on. However, John Irwin is still with us. He voiced Reggie Mantle, along with Dick Tracy and He-Man for Filmation. And when the two Biffs from Back to the Future 2 are listening to the radio, that's his voice as the radio announcer. I've read that he's reclusive, but can you use your powers and abilities to score an interview with him? That would be a joy to listen to." Well, howdy to you, Ernest. Thanks so much for writing in. Good to hear from you. I do know that the Spider-Man Rock comic, of course you've seen it on YouTube, but it's available on iTunes. But from what I've read, I believe someone or some company had digitized the vinyl version, so it's not high-quality audio. That might be what you're hearing in the YouTube video as well. That said, still cool to kind of hear those hisses and pops. I like them. It's a vinyl record. I love that about vinyl, especially those digitized versions of the old Power Records set. We've talked about those here on the show. So that's kind of cool. So it's out there. You can buy it. It's not a cleaned-up version. It's, you know, not high quality, but we can still hear it. John Irwin, I think you hit the nail on the head. Very tough to reach. I don't know necessarily that it's him being reclusive so much as it is him being retired. I've reached out to some connections to see if they can put the word out. We'll see. Again, if people are enjoying their retirement, don't want to do these kind of things, that's totally understandable and respect that. But we'll see if we hear back. But that said, stay tuned. There is more Archie goodness headed your way here on Comic Book Central. I promise you that. The next email is from Maximilian Mendoza, who writes, "What great podcast you have. All my childhood heroes are here. I've only been able to listen to a handful so far, but I'm looking forward to many more. My favorite so far has been the one with Joanna Cameron. She never does interviews. It was great to hear her voice again. And speaking of voices, hearing Shannon Farnan's voice as Wonder Woman took me back to being 8 years old again. She still has the best voice." Well, thanks for writing in, Maximilian. Welcome to the show, by the way. Thanks for downloading those past episodes. Glad to hear you're enjoying them. Couldn't agree with you more. That is a huge part of the fun for me here on the show. It's very tough for me not to feel like a little kid again when I'm talking to some of these folks. So, you get these childhood heroes, these voices you hear, the people you see there, you talk to them. But glad you also enjoyed the Joanna Cameron interview. You're right. She does not do many interviews, if any, at all. So I think she's also enjoying her post-acting life as well. But she was gracious enough to join me here in the lair. We all benefited from that, so that was kind of cool. By the way, speaking of those episodes, Shazam, Isis, the Filmation shows, and feeling like a little kid again, I'm going to repeat, you are days away from my Comic Book Central exclusive Shazam surprise. It's on the way. It's going to be here. You want to hear it. You want to find out what it is. If you haven't already, subscribe to the show, folks. Follow on Twitter. Like on Facebook. You get the episodes that way. Check them out in the archive. ComicBookCentral.net. You're going to want to join in the fun each and every week. I'm just saying, there's a lot of cool stuff coming. So, and don't forget to drop me a line. I want to hear from you. joe@comicbookcentral.net. And don't forget to share the lair. Hashtag share the lair. Share it on Facebook. Retweet it on Twitter. You folks that are doing that, you're getting the show out to many more people. I appreciate it. And then folks like Maximilian find out about the show. They join us here for the fun as well. So check it out. The show posts Saturday each and every week. Share it with your friends. They're going to love it as well. All right, Trekkers and Trekkies, that is it for today. I'm going to head on over to Quark's Bar for a tall, cold one. I'll see if Constable Odo would like to join me, belly up to the bar. But I'm going to be back before you know it, because next week on Comic Book Central, oh yeah, you know who's going to be here. I already said it. Back-to-back Trek, that's what's coming your way. Nana Visitor. Well, she's going to be here. She's going to be here. She's Kira from Deep Space Nine. She was in the spirit with Sam Jones. We're going to talk about that movie as well. She's going to be here. You're going to be here. You're not going to miss this one, are you? I didn't think so. Until next week, keep on trekking, keep reading those comic books, especially those free ones. Thanks for joining me here in the Lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 imported license. All of the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
That's Master Hair by Reynolds, and the other is called Religious Subject from the School of Morello.
I remember these paintings from the Lincoln Gallery here in Washington, huh?
What you see there, Jamie, and what millions of tourists and students have seen for the past year, national treasures of this country, are fakes, frauds.
That's amazing. Like, this forger is a genius.
Well, you might call him that, along with several less flattering descriptions. Send him in.
Monsieur, perhaps you can clear up this terrible mistake. I am Jacques Leroy, a wine merchant from Bordeaux.
Jamie, this is Pierre-Francois Lambert, a mediocre painter in his own right, but an extraordinary forger and all-around fraud.
Monsieur, mademoiselle, please listen to me. I told you my name is...
Sit on it, Pierre.